take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Wanna take a ride? Ha baby, we're on a ride. It has begun, and your ticket is punched. We're all on it. We've reached peak oil. I think that's obvious. The second half, a lot left, is going to be real hard and very expensive to get. And as we dig for it, the price is going to go up and up and up and up. And our economy, if we're not careful, is going to go down and down and down and down. One of the saviors, one of the realistic possible saviors, is something called nanotechnology. My guest coming up is going to tell us all about it. His name is Charles Ossman. Charles Ossman is a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures and serves with the management team of Fourth Venture. Charles is also chair of the Nanoelectronics and Photonics Forum of NanoSig, senior consultant with Silicon Valley Nano Ventures, and he serves on the scientific advisory board of Legendary Pharmaceuticals. Wow! He is an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Future Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. He has authored numerous technical papers and published articles, lectures frequently around the country and abroad, has contributed content featured in a number of books. He has been a featured guest and speaker in a diverse variety of nationally broadcast TV and radio programs. Charles has 25 plus years experience in the fields of electronics, material science, computing, artificial intelligence, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Labs and the University of California, Berkeley, and Los Alamos National Laboratory. In a moment, subject nanotechnology guest Charles Ossman. This man really knows what he's talking about. Now, I have a brain that operates, you know, like in a 15-mile-per-hour school zone type deal, right? Charles has a mouth driven by a brain that operates, you know, at 100 miles an hour. So we're going to have to slow him down every now and then. That's my recollection of the Charles Ossman of old. Now, it's been, I don't know, a long time. I interviewed you, Charles, years ago now. It is years ago, right?
I think it was in 96, if I remember correctly.
96?
Correct, yeah.
Well, that's my memory that you can really get going.
I've been accused of worse, but that's fine.
I mean, just really rapid delivery, which is great, except you're going to have to slow yourself down for mere mortals out here.
I understand, and I very much appreciate being back in the program. I really appreciate the forum, because I think it's the only forum like it on the planet.
And it is.
It serves a wonderful purpose, and I'll give credit to George Nuri, who I think has done a tremendous job in carrying on the
program. Absolutely. There's no other program like this anywhere. Period. It's just what it is. All right. Anyway, enough of that. Listen, Charles, since in the years, I was saying this earlier in the first hour, that when we first did the program, it was like a lot of other shows we do, things that are probably very likely going to happen, but very far in the future. You know, we are a forward-looking program, and it was kind of in the future when you were on last, but my God, since you've been on last, nanotechnology has exploded.
It's like your book, The Quickening. It's The Quickening in this context. And in fact, I've been working on a book kind of like that, but with a different perspective. But you're 100% right. And in fact, the rate of acceleration is accelerating itself.
Maybe you could call it nano quickening.
If you wish. But one way to measure this process. In other words, there's different. You know, many, many different people now have a vision of nanotech in their own particular realm of familiarity. But from my vantage point, I work with a lot of patent attorneys and also a lot of VCs or venture capitalists. And so I have to wear a very specific kind of hat. I have to measure technologies, not from a, gee whiz, how interesting, but rather will it make money and is it legally definable as a patentable item?
Apparently.
In that context, there's over 1,000 companies now producing something to do with nanotechnology.
There you go. That's what I said. It's happening now. But let's back up, Charles. There are a lot of people, honestly. You're going to have to do the 101.
That's fine. No, I'm happy to do it. So this is my version of how I see nanotechnology to be. The simplest possible sort of Occam's razor approach would be it's the precise manipulation of matter at the molecular scale of interaction. And what that means is our attempt or our hope is to be able to get molecules, individual molecules, to sort of move about and assemble themselves in some kind of useful way. And in fact, nature's been doing this for billions of years. We're just trying to, in a sense, copy a little bit from what nature has been doing all along and see if we can do a
How does man move a molecule?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, let me explain how nature does it. It might be helpful. If one were to, say, open up a living cell, most cells at least anyway, what you'll find inside those cells are these little machine-like objects called organelles. And the organelles come in many different types and flavors. I won't go into all the detail, but there's generally ribosomes and mitochondria and proteasomes and a bunch of other devices, if you will. And their purpose is to, in a sense, build molecules as the cell's physiology needs them. And they get the instructions from this from what are called messenger proteins. And these proteins come in many different types as well. But the basic idea is it's kind of like a software routine that then instructs these little assembly units how to build molecules as they're needed. So in a very rough analogy kind of way, we're hoping to either instigate controlled assembly by using organic means, and I can explain a lot about that, and there are other material systems which are just beginning to be developed where molecules can be sort of instigated to cooperate based on some kind of combination of chemistry, physics, a bit of material science, but the general idea is you can attract molecules or repel molecules, either with electrical charge, water, different compounds, or a series of different stimulus events, you might say, the end result being some kind of a structure that comes from the molecules having been told what to do.
So through different sciences, you mentioned material sciences,
yes,
chemistry maybe, perhaps the use of magnetic fields, who knows what, you instruct these molecules to assemble in a certain way.
Yes.
I picture somebody with a very teeny little thing in a microscope pushing a molecule incredibly.
Well, as a matter of fact, Don Eagle, who's very famous now, he's at IBM research facility in Almaden. He's a very neat guy, somebody that you might want to have on the air as well, but he actually sort of made world history by moving individual atoms around using an atomic force microscope. And in fact, it's gotten to the point now where you can actually dial up on the internet. I'm not sure what the web address is, but he's done this before for public demonstration. And mainly for school kids and that kind of thing, you can actually go on the website and move atoms around. Now, that kind of a process is great science, but it's not really practical. You're not going to make large objects or lots of objects that way. It's just too slow. But as a research instrument, it's a wonderful way to demonstrate the process. What we're looking for now, in a commercial sense, is how to do this on a much larger basis.
Right.
That is to, like, for instance, computer chips or integrated devices. Or like you were saying earlier, the paint that can be a solar...
All right, now I hear that this is already being sold.
Yeah, it is.
Can you verify that?
Absolutely.
All right, now, let's get this straight. This
sure.
is a paint that you can paint your house with.
Sure.
And then you... Do you know anything about it?
Yeah,
do you know,
of course.
For example,
I can go into great detail. In fact, I chair twice a year the Nanoelectronics Forum Conference. Our next event's going to be in July 14. And NanoSolar, one of the companies that's doing this, will be one of our presenters.
All right, then get specific with me. What can
sure.
be done?
Well, for instance, I'll skip over the chemistry because it is a little complex, but the basic idea is this. In traditional solar cells, they're made with silicon. You have to grow silicon crystals, what's called monocrystalline silicon, which is kind of expensive, and it's a tricky thing to do. It's not ever going to really be used on a mass basis, although it is in some areas. However, using organic materials, that again can be instigated to, in a sense, self-organize, and depending upon how the molecules are arranged in certain layers and so forth, you can now create either a paint or, through what's called roll-to-roll manufacturing, it's kind of like printing, if you will, it's printing chemistry on a surface, you can create very inexpensive both solar and thermal photovoltaics. That could be roofing tiles, it could be paint on a surface,
All right, this is what I want to know about. Here's where I get stuck, Trump.
Okay, sure.
All right, so I go to the local Ace's, the place, and buy a gallon of nano paint.
Sure, exactly.
And I come home and I paint my home. Now, I want to draw electrical current from this. I was sitting there trying to figure out, well, so what do? Do I attach a positive lead somewhere to the house and then a ground lead and I get this electrical charge? Or how in God's name, is it delivered? I can't grasp it.
It's surprisingly simple. Imagine the top side being one pole and the bottom side being the other pole. I mean, that's a little overly simplified, but that's kind of the general idea.
What do you mean the top side, one pole?
Well, it's a layer of material. And in a sense, photons are instigating electrons to migrate from one boundary to the next. All I really have to do is tap into that flow rate.
So are you saying you have to have two coats of different stuff?
The paint stuff, I haven't seen physically, so I don't want to comment on that, but I certainly have seen the laminated organic materials that are actually several layers.
Okay, so you can't, you really then can't answer my question, because I was trying to figure out, how do you actually collect the voltage and current from this painted house? Do you have some place on the house where you have some sort of electrode sticking out, and then you go to ground, or what in the heck?
I can speak for the roll-to-roll manufactured stuff, which is basically the same chemistry, so
all
I'm
right.
going to assume it uses the same general concept. But
that's
in the roll-to-roll laminates, there are literally several layers of material, and so you essentially place electrodes on different layers, and that's how you're capturing the flow of electron current. So I'm imagining you probably do have multiple panes of code. That may be how that works.
And I would like to know whether it's the laminate situation you're talking about or paint, what kind of actual voltage and current could one expect?
Okay,
I mean, the efficiency is very high, I understand.
Well, it depends on which chemistry you're looking at and what the durability is, and this is where it gets a little more complicated, so forgive me. In fact, if you go to companies like Mio Soleil or Canarca is another one, there's a handful of these companies, by the way, which are going commercial as we speak. They all have somewhat different chemistries. In fact, there's actually a company here in the Bay Area called NanoSys.
All right, give me an average.
Okay, well, on average, it's probably going to be less than silicon. But the flip side is it's drastically cheaper, so you can cover huge areas and with almost no cost compared to what it costs.
Okay, fine. Let's say we had a huge area covered. I'm actually interested in how much voltage and how much current could I produce from a house or even a giant anything painted with this stuff or laminated with this stuff.
You could produce thousands. You could eventually, if you had enough surface area, sir, you could produce thousands of watts. There's no reason you couldn't. And let me tell you where the next step is going, just to kind of get into this a little further. In the realm of what are called quantum dots, and I'm sorry to have to toss this word at you, but quantum dots are sort of nanoscale particles, and the particle size actually determines the bandwidth of light or the spectral signature of how they respond.
Okay.
Now, why is it interesting? Well, the reason that's interesting is because, if you can coat the outer surface with a layer of quantum dots, and there's a special trick for doing that, then all of a sudden you can dramatically increase the efficiency because you can fine-tune the exact characteristic of light that's reaching into the layers that's actually doing the conversion. And so there are several companies now, including one in Canada that I'm working with or I'm familiar with, that's actually perfecting this process. And you'll see patents in the next year or two where you have the quantum dot enhanced version.
I've heard of the quantum dots, and I've heard of the Canadian firm, I believe, that is doing this.
Yes.
Are people becoming successful in getting patents on this?
Yes, they are. And in fact, not to plug my event too much, but we're actually sponsored by a law firm, Townsend, Townsend & Crew, and they're one of the major law firms that's filing IP as we speak.
Hmm. And for how long, then, are you protected with regard to the use of that specific technology?
Well, now, this is patent law, and I don't want to claim to be an expert in patent law, although I've certainly done my share of reading patents, but I you know, you can file a provisional patent which lasts for a year, I believe, as a kind of a placeholder, then you actually file a regular patent. And I think the statute of limitations, oh, gosh, I'm going to get this wrong probably. Some are 7 years and some are 15 years, and I forget which the difference is.
But you know, there are those saying that as desperate as the world's energy situation is, these patents ought not be allowed, that all of this should be given to the world free of charge.
Well, let me offer kind of a sideways argument, if I might.
You might.
Okay. I have spent many years working in government institutions, Lawrence Lab and Los Alamos and that kind of thing, and I work with government institutions even to this very day in some context. And there's a good place for that. And having the public sector being the primary catalyst to get the initial research funded, I understand that's a good thing to do. However, it has a flip side to that coin. The flip side says when you allow the government to get monopolize a certain technical spectrum of interest, like the space programs, for instance, since you were mentioning NASA earlier, what happens is these things often get mired in politics and take much longer than they need to take and much more expensive and so on. When I saw Spaceship One get launched, which to me was really cool because I actually met Burt Rutan many years ago, this signified something special to me. It wasn't just that a small private company with a little bit of outside help got a spacecraft into orbit. What was really interesting was that this was done via the private sector. It was like an end run around the much larger, sometimes rather Byzantine kind of enterprises that control these things.
Yeah, I saw the whole streaming thing. It was damn astounding.
That would be good for the words. And so I suggest to you, and I offer this to your audience as well, that maybe we're at a point in time where the government bureaucracies are simply too slow, and I use that kind of cautiously, to really match in synchronicity the requirement to get things off the ground. And so if the private sector, through venture capital and through small startup companies, can sort of burst on the scene with their breakthrough versions of whatever energy technology.
Yes. And for that reason, there need to be patents, is your argument.
Sure.
The private sector can make money, so they have incentive to do it.
Indeed. So, no, I can guess where you're going, though, and I'm going to be a little psychic here. I do know that there is a long-standing practice of people buying up patents and then putting the patents on the shelf to prevent them from getting into the public arena.
No. Does that happen?
That happens indeed so. And this is a very dicey area, so I don't want to step into a boiling pit of controversy at the very first 5 minutes of your program, although I'm sure that's going to happen anyway.
Wouldn't bother me.
But it is kind of a mixed bag, and we have to take a balanced approach. Let me give you a different perspective, if I might.
You might.
You remember when Craig Venter launched the company Solera, and for those that are not familiar, perhaps, there was when the Human Genome Project was ongoing, there was a huge battle between the NSF, headed by Francis Collins, and then the private version called Solera. And Francis Collins and Craig Venter were kind of like blood enemies at one point, because Francis Collins said it was going to take billions of dollars in 12 years or whatever it was to get the human genome cracked, and the inventor said, I'll do it in 3 years for $500 million. You know? So, I mean, clearly this was kind of a direct challenge to the traditional sort of government way of doing things.
So does he have a patent on the human genome?
Well, he does have a patent on the genome, exactly, but he certainly has a lot of patents on the processes that led up to it. But more importantly, let me tell you what Craig Venter is doing.
There will be no changes in human beings unless it goes through our office.
But the point is, it was a dramatic indicator of how differently the same goal can be met through two completely different parallel agendas. And just as an aside, by the way, you might be interested in this. Craig Venter's current ambition right now is to search the open oceans for microbes that can produce high amounts of methane. Why is that interesting? The reason is that if we can use microbes, albeit maybe genetically modified, to produce methane, which produces hydrogen,
yes,
then all of a sudden we have a way of growing hydrogen, literally as a farm, as a farmable commodity, as opposed to digging holes in the ground and getting oil. This is something that I think is very valuable, and he's willing to finance this through his own private company.
Well, something like that, or better, it better come along and soon. We're really headed for
I agree. In fact, to give you a kind of a snapshot, I've been to many, many meetings, some of which I probably won't talk about in the air, but one which I will. I was at the Woodrow Wilson Institute in Washington, D.C. about a year ago, and I happened to share the stage with Richard Smalley, who actually won the Nobel Prize for his work in fullerene chemistry, and a lot of other people were there. But the whole context of the meeting was, we know energy is a problem, we see peak oil, we know it loud and clear. Even military people were there, and they believe me, they all saw the same thing.
So what can you do about it?
Here's what I think will probably happen in my own vision of things. It's not going to be anyone's solution fits all, and I think this is kind of where people tend to go wrong a little bit. They think that, okay, we're going to scrap oil tomorrow and go into hydrogen. It's not going to happen that way, but I think what will happen will be a variety, kind of like a mosaic of different...
Name some of them.
Okay, I think biofuels is a very good place to start. The whole idea of biodiesel, for instance.
Nothing nano about that, though.
Well, let me continue, if I may. Where the nano part comes in, by the way, think of it like this. If one can make materials that have specialized properties, like, for instance, that would be used in fuel cells, as an example, where the current manufacturing is kind of expensive and kind of tricky and requires a lot of complicated manufacturing steps, especially for like the membranes and that kind of thing, if that could be optimized by a much less costly way to make the fuel cells, then all of a sudden it looks like a much more commercially viable concept.
All right. Hold on, Charles. We're at the bottom of the hour. Commercial concepts, little things, nanotechnology, trying to cure a really big thing, and that would be peak oil in the declining years. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good morning.
Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. My guest is Charles Ostman. We're talking about bio. Yeah, we are talking about biofuels, I guess, but nanotechnology, and he mentioned biofuels as we're talking about things that might help to slow down the long emergency and, you know, the ultimate crisis point. And we're going to try and lay those things out for you, if they really do exist or will shortly, in a moment. Remember the old thing about spinning straw into gold, or lead into gold, or, I don't know, water into oil, or whatever. I guess what I'm really asking, and you mentioned bio, is whether nanotechnology holds the promise of ordering materials at a molecular level to get together and become oil, or become some other combustible energy, to change their nature and become combustible and usable as an energy source.
Well, I wouldn't try to approach trying to replicate petrochemicals or, you know, hydrocarbon-based fuels. That may be kind of a different direction. But I would suggest that there are other ways to approach the same problem.
And they would be.
Well, and for instance, it's not just the consumption of fuel, it's also the efficiency of how the fuel is used.
And given?
You can approach both sides.
Give me an example how you increase the efficiency with nanotechnology.
Well, for instance, the simplest answer would be something like, say, carbon nanofibers, which is a spectacular invention, really. It really revolutionizes the whole concept of strength-to-weight ratio and how things can be manufactured. And we're not going to see carbon nanotubes in a car tomorrow, although there are tennis rackets made with them now, I should point out.
And I want to get the whole story on something. If there's, all right, tennis rackets made of what, nanotubes?
Yes, carbon nanofibers.
And what do they do?
Okay. The carbon nanofibers, imagine now carbon atoms arranging themselves in a very perfect hexagonal pattern.
Okay.
And you're thinking, well, so what? But here's why that's so interesting. Because once they align themselves up in that kind of a pattern, then it's a pretty straightforward process to make tubes, spheroids, so-called buckyballs. And in fact, this is what Richard Smalley won his Nobel Prize in, was developing the...
Okay, fine. There's already tennis rackets. What do these tennis rackets do that regular ones don't?
They have spectacular tensile strength. They have spectacular strength-to-weight ratio. It's not so much that you're going to play a wonderful game of tennis, which you will, but what I'm hoping to point to is that if we could eventually make cars, for instance.
Cars?
Yes, cars, utilizing this kind of a material, then all of a sudden you have a much lighter vehicle, which is much stronger than the current vehicles could ever possibly be.
Lighter, stronger, then much more efficient.
Correct.
Less fuel to make it go from A to B.
That's exactly right. And let me walk down the path a little further, since we did ask the question. Another concept is lubrication. The less friction you have, the more you gain. And there's
right.
a tremendous amount of opportunity in nanoscale materials that can be used as replacement for current lubricants.
Now, as a replacement for lubricants? Well,
correct.
Now we use oil now.
Well, yes, indeed, which is actually a very sloppy and sort of inefficient way to loosen or lessen friction and reduce
And heat. What would be better?
Well, again, if you have nano components or nanostructured materials which are perfect in their size and shape and sort of distribution over a given surface, and there's a lot being done.
Oh.
Then all of a sudden you need a much thinner coating of the material, which would last much longer, not need to be replaced, and the engine itself would run much smoother using less energy.
Got it. So the piston walls,
correct,
would be so perfect.
It would be a complete change of the current way of looking at how these engines run. But let me walk a little bit further, if I may. I mean, right now we're looking at hybrid cars. And hybrid cars are kind of a combination between traditional combustion engines and using batteries. And when the car slows down or brakes, you actually capture that energy and then refeed that back into the batteries and so on, which is, I think, a very good idea. I think this is a very good intermediate step. So let's talk about batteries for a moment. The battery technology world is also going to be changed by nanotechnology because... Once again, you can have a much higher charge density and a much longer lifetime, if you will, for the materials. Now, this is still a few years away. But
again, I want to stop you. Let's say we had a nano battery, a 1.5-volt flashlight size nano battery.
It may not be a flashlight size, but, you know, something a lot smaller than your garden variety batteries are now.
I don't care then. Make it a watch battery. All right. I just want a comparison between
sure.
A current battery and something that would be constructed by nanotechnology.
Because, again, in current batteries, like your garden variety car battery, you have a lead acid battery. It's plates of lead suspended in an acid.
That's system, right.
Which has been around for, you know, a century or more. But the problem is if you try to fill up an entire car with these things, which some of the earlier electric vehicles did, it's very bad if, A, the car crashes and you have battery acid everywhere, and, B, the batteries don't last very long. And there's a lot of reasons why it's not so good.
C, they're very heavy.
Very heavy, and just a dangerous thing to do. By extreme contrast, and there are several companies working on this now, which I won't go into because they're still under sort of patent filing, but the basic idea is...
All these secrets.
Well, I'm so sorry, but in just
All
a very
right,
general
just give
way...
give me an idea, a watch battery. You know, usually my watch battery, Charles, it lasts about a year. After about a year... You go, oh, damn, and you have to go to Radio Shack and get a new one. So if you had something constructed by nanotechnology, what might we expect?
We would expect it there that could be recharged many, many times over again, hold the charge much longer, and not degrade over time. That would be the ultimate goal. And again, the reason is because you can now force the particles or the substrates within the battery to much more precisely align themselves. Think of it like this. In traditional chemistry, you're trying to mix together a couple of solutions, you catalyze the reaction, out the other end comes another solution. But that's only with a bulk of material, and then all the molecules are still kind of loosely flopping around inside that material. What you're hoping to do is create a much more structured, much more precise way to get all the molecules in question to form up into a pattern or to form into layers or whatever the target goal might be.
Much like I'd like a much more precise answer. I've got a 1 year watch battery.
Yeah.
If I've got one that you're thinking of in the future, how long might it last?
It might last forever. Just depends on how often you have to charge it and how severe the discharge process is.
Well, for one thing, I don't charge watch batteries. I throw them away.
Well, I understand that, and perhaps I'm using a somewhat bad analogy. I was referring more to a car battery, actually.
Okay.
But, you know, since we're talking about energy, I was hoping to try to sort of focus on that. And the basic idea is that if we could ever get to the point where the package that would power a car, even if it was only partially powered by electricity, would not have to use lead-acid batteries, but instead would use one of these new solid-state layered materials.
Right.
The weight would be much smaller, you could recharge the battery many, many times over again, and you would actually have a very commercially compatible solution to the current sort of attempt at hybrid cars.
How far away from that might we be?
I would say realistically 5 to 7 years, roughly, and again, especially in cars, and this may be a difficult answer, but to try to implement any kind of a major change in an automotive assembly line process, it takes about 10 years to go from prototype to field test to market survey to eventually putting.
No, I think I was asking about how far to the battery itself, the creation of a nanotechnological battery.
There are several companies working on them as we speak.
Uh-huh.
I'm probably going to be a little bit hesitant to give you an exact answer, but I would say, from what I can understand, probably about 5 to 7 years when you start seeing commercial prototypes.
All right, I understand there are already, there's clothing on the market right now.
Yes, indeed.
Made by nanotechnology.
That's correct.
Is that right? What does this clothing do that my shirt or my pants don't do now?
Okay, well, I have a friend in England. Her name is Jenny Tilbinson, and she's actually been working on something. She has a company called Sensory Designs, and her approach is to actually build sensors right into the fabric of the clothing itself. Now, her first product actually is going to be, believe it or not, to detect pregnancy in women. I'm not kidding. by pheromone release.
Really?
It's actually been supported by a British pharmaceutical company.
So what happens? My God, that's incredible. So a woman has a dress on.
Yeah.
And it decides that she's pregnant and
indeed
begins
so.
And begins. Let me get this straight. Let me just guess. It begins to grow with the baby.
Well, not exactly. Actually, there's a color change, but.
Oh really?
Oh yeah, but she's also working on couture gowns and things that will change with your mood.
Well, since we're going that far, why don't we have it change? Pink for a girl and blue for a boy.
I'm sure it could be worked out. But the basic concept of smart fibers has been around for several years. In fact, there was a company called Molecular Geodesics, which was doing some work for DARPA, and their interest was in a smart fabric that could filter out certain kinds of microbes or viruses and then actually tell the soldier that he was being attacked by the microbe in question by a response from the cloth.
Wow.
And that goes back several years ago. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is kind of hidden away in the military, but as is the case with any other technology paradigm, it usually takes about a decade or so between the first prototypes, usually which are in the military domain, and then they eventually filter into the commercial world. And we're seeing the outcome of that now.
Could there become something as lightweight as, I'll say, your average Marine Corps uniform? That when it detected a bullet was coming at it, toughened up and became something that would bounce the bullet.
You're 100% on the mark. Surprising that you would make that comment, because that's exactly one of the projects I actually saw. It was a sort of a, not exactly a cloth, it's more like a plastic-like membrane, but that's exactly what would happen. If a bullet impacted it, it would immediately harden up around the bullet. It was kind of like a new kind of bulletproof vest.
Around the bullet?
Yeah, it would just harden up a zone. The impact zone would cause like an epicenter that would then radiate out from the point of impact, and it would harden up at that spot.
That's incredible.
And that goes back about 2 or 3 years, as far as I know.
2 or 3 years?
The first prototypes that I read about.
Well, you see, you just know the military would not just be interested in something like that. They would be fanatically.
Oh, they're funding it big time. In fact, there's something at MIT called the Soldier of the Future Project, which it's on public domain, so you can download the website yourself. But basically, the tip of the iceberg of this kind of stuff you can find there, examples of it, And I, in fact, personally have spoken at a number of sort of DARPA-oriented conferences, and they've asked specific questions about certain areas, and I've given answers. But, I mean, there's a lot of this going on. I think the Homeland Security concept being presented to the general public may hasten, actually, a lot of this stuff getting out into the general world, which I think would be a good thing. I mean, in terms of things that can detect biohazards, smart clothing that could be protective, and, you know, things of that nature. I can see this moving in the fast path pretty quickly.
Will a lot of this get to the civilian populace as quickly as it does to the military black project money?
That's a tricky question, and I will try to answer it to the best of my ability. The reason black project money goes so far and does so quickly is because, and this is the double-edged sword, it's not under the auspices of congressional control. There's no oversight committee that says spend money on this and do not spend money on that. So they have
that,
kind of the freedom to go explore all kinds of wild things, many of which don't work, by the way, but those that do get into the fast track of deployment. And so, yes, out of the black projects world, the timeline could be anything from a handful of years to maybe a decade or so. It depends on really what it is and what the motives are.
So black project money really is a scientist's best friend.
In a sense, yes. And look, I'm not pro-military exactly, but I do understand the requirement, and I can sort of understand the justification. So there's
as
many,
well as the facts of life.
It's the facts of life. That is true. Yeah.
How much of a hold does the military have on some of this developing technology right now?
A lot. I mean, they get it. I mean, they have really decided that there's something interesting here. And nanotechnology, I have to make this point, is a very, very broad range of different kinds of scientific disciplines all sort of merged together. It's not exactly like a narrow single tangent of scientific research. It's a much broader realm. So it's kind of hard to answer the question to say, well, how much nanotechnology is the military involved with? Because actually, if you were to take the broader view, just about everything from aerospace to the next generation of aircraft to armored vehicles to smart garments and just a whole lot of other things, all of which have some aspect of nanotechnology connected to them as we speak.
All right. But at least some of it's happening out here in the private sector.
Yes, indeed so.
All right. What else have you heard about that's coming? I remember someone telling me, for example, about windows or even walls that could, for example, on your wish or your command, and I don't know how that would be made, but they would suddenly go from a wall that nobody could see through to something completely clear, like a perfect window.
Oh, absolutely.
Virtually disappearing before your eyes.
This has already been done. In fact, there are so
well, already been done.
There are smart windows. You can buy these things if you wish. They're expensive, but you can buy them.
Wait, what will they do?
Well, imagine now, kind of like a smart shutter. That is, if you have... think back a few years ago. There used to be these, I think you can still buy them. There were glasses that you could buy that would sort of change color over time. So now imagine dramatically accelerating that process, where it goes from completely clear to totally opaque in a millisecond or two.
In a millisecond or two. That's virtually like that.
Exactly right. And it's done with electrical charge. And so, again, this was... dramatically increased because, or the efficiency or the effectiveness, I should say, was increased because of the precision with which the different layers of the material could be formed up on the surface of the plate or the carrier material. And that's really what makes a lot of this come to pass, is the way that you can get a bunch of molecules to suddenly behave themselves.
I mean, you've actually seen it?
Oh, yes.
How cool is it? I mean, I imagine you're looking at something solid. Somebody throws a wall switch, an electric current flows, and boom, it becomes completely...
Completely clear, like a window, exactly. It's quite something. I kind of...
Where did you see that?
Oh, heavens. Actually, there was a demonstration of that at the NextFest conference, which was here in San Francisco last year, but it's been around for a couple of years.
That's going to be popular.
It's kind of pricey, but I think once the production process gets ironed out, it'll be common.
Of course, it's... pricey, new things always are, but that's going to be incredibly popular. I mean, the people with homes overlooking San Francisco on a nice night, they throw a switch and boom, there it is. The walls are gone, and there's San Francisco laid out in front of them, but the heating and the cooling and all remain just the same.
One more caveat, if I could throw that in, because you're tapping into something. Since we were talking about energy, another big piece of this puzzle is in the power grid, you know, home energy supplies and industry and that kind of thing.
Yes.
An enormous amount of effort is being spent on how to make buildings and houses much more efficient using materials kind of like this in a way. In other words, if we can, capture both waste heat and waste light.
Absolutely.
And convert it into something useful. That's an enormous breakthrough.
Absolutely.
And I would suggest there are dozens of companies now who are pushing at this because they see the dollars waiting for them, and so they're going for it.
Well, that's it. But the dollars are waiting for them because all of this can be patented, right?
That's part of the process. Now, just to tell the audience how this works, usually when venture capital groups say, we like something, let's have a look at it, the first thing they want to know is, what's the patent status? I mean, that's not the beginning.
Of course, because that's if they're going to invest money, they want to know they're going to get a return.
That is exactly right. And, you know, this is a good and a bad thing. I'm not saying this is a panacea. I'm just saying this is how that particular process works. But to kind of carry on a step further, I think that there are many people now who are much more willing to recognize that we have to sort of turn a corner in terms of our energy policy, not just with cars, but with everything, electrical grids and the whole nine yards. So the acceptance of looking at new things is much greater than it was before, and therefore the motivation to invest in these things is much more than it once was. And I think that actually is a good thing.
All right. Well, whether it's in the private sector or in the military, Charles, any technology, nanotechnology, definitely fits into this category. Extremely powerful. It's already proving itself to be so.
Yes, indeed.
But also potentially extremely dangerous.
This is true.
And I want some real truth from you on this subject in the next hour. I mean, I think most of the audience has heard the Grey Goose story. Although I guess we'll run through the possibility of Grey Goo. Scientists both in the private sector and in the government military sector tend to go ahead and do things to see what happens, you know?
And I'm not necessarily gleefully on that side of the fence, and there is certain dangers, and in fact, we will gladly go into
it. All right. We'll, in a moment. From the high desert in the middle of the night, talking of the small stuff, nanotechnology, I'm Art Bell.